loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at three big stories. First, it's the first day of the Paul Manafort trial, the first trial to come out of the Mueller probe. His charges, felony bank fraud and tax evasion, are not related to any alleged meddling by the Russian government or collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. Then President Trump said yesterday that he would meet Iranian leaders without preconditions, quote, wherever they want, close quote. The comments marked an abrupt about-face in Trump's Iran policy, but Secretary of State Mike Pompeo walked the comment back. Hours later, the Iranian government rejected the notion of a meeting. And then, finally, we continue our weekly series. Every Tuesday, it's called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. Today, we discuss proposed tax cuts for the wealthy and what they mean for the economy and for the public.
But before we get to those three stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, in a classified leak to the Washington Post, U.S. intelligence officials say that North Korea is constructing new missiles at a factory that produced the country's first intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of reaching the United States. Is North Korea rearming, or is the intelligence community trying to kill the warming of relations between the two countries? Next, British journalist Robert Fisk recently concluded an investigative report on weapons deliveries to belligerents in Syria, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda. He found that many of the weapons, including missiles and rockets, were made by U.S. defense contractors and sold to NATO and friendly countries in the region. They were then sent to Syria in violation of end-user agreements. Then, Puerto Rico's government last night reached a deal with a bondholder group to restructure more than a third of the $9 billion debt owed by the island's electrical utility, PREPA, as it moves toward privatization. Economists say the deal, while helping Puerto Rico in the short term, will likely lead to an overall increase in the rates of interest poor cities, states, and territories must pay on bonds. And then President Trump yesterday lashed out at the billionaire Koch brothers, two of the Republican Party's most prolific fundraisers, calling them, quote, a total joke, unquote, and saying that he never sought their support because he didn't need their money or their bad ideas. MSNBC host Joe Scarborough said the outburst points to Trump's destruction of the Republican Party. Why would the president provoke such a fight within his own base? And finally, the U.S. military's Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which is based in Germany, announced yesterday that it had begun deploying armed drones to Niger earlier this year. Niger agreed to the request as part of its joint counterterrorism work with the U.S. But why did it take so long to release the information? And why is AFRICOM nowhere near Africa? And in other headlines, an immigrant detention center in Texas was found to be administering heavy psychotropic drugs to migrant children in their custody without parental permission. The center has claimed that this was on an emergency basis only, but many children said they were medicated day and night, some to the point of being unable to walk. Palestinian poet Doreen Tatour has been sentenced to 5 months in prison by an Israeli court for posting a poem to social media. Tatour was convicted of inciting terrorism. This comes shortly after Israel came under heavy international criticism for its new law declaring the country an exclusively Jewish state. Instructions for 3D printing guns are set to go on the market at midnight, despite skepticism expressed by President Trump over Twitter. The designs will allow people with 3D printers to manufacture their own handguns and semi-automatic assault rifles. Attorneys general from 8 states and Washington, D.C. have sued to block the release of the instructions. Teachers in Argentina are wrapping up a 48-hour strike today. The action was aimed at pressuring the government of President Mauricio Macri to reinstate the practice of holding regular sector-wide meetings between unions and the government to discuss salary increases and inflation. These meetings were implemented under the progressive Kirchner government, but have been rolled back since Macri, a staunch right-winger, was elected in 2015. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the trial of former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort. It began today in federal court in Alexandria, Virginia. Manafort is charged with 18 counts of felony bank fraud and tax evasion. The trial is expected to take 3 weeks, and then he will face additional felony charges in a federal court in Washington, D.C. We're joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. who is the author of several books, including The Plot to Attack Iran. Dan Kovalik, welcome back.
Thank you.
You know, I'm looking, John and Dan, at the New York Times front page about this much-awaited Manafort trial. Manafort was, for a brief amount of time in 2016, in the summer of 2016, the campaign chairman of Donald Trump's 2016 election bid until Trump fired him. But here's the headline. Manafort trial pushes Russia to the sideline. And then I'll read the first paragraph. When they present their evidence in the financial fraud trial of Paul Manafort beginning this week, federal prosecutors have promised the judge no government witness will even utter the word Russia. Russia inevitably looms over the entire proceeding anyway. I mean, that's kind of an important point because this is the Mueller probe, which is the Russia probe. And this is the big trial. And Manafort was the campaign chairman. And the government has now promised the judge that the word Russia will not be uttered.
Yeah. This is the headliner trial, the marquee that everybody's been waiting for. 18 felony charges. And Russia's not involved in a single
one. And Russia's not going to be mentioned. Go ahead, Dan.
It tells you everything you need to know about this investigation, that they haven't found any evidence of collusion. And so they are going after these sometimes just completely unrelated cases, which Manafort's case is. This involves improprieties related to Ukraine, not to Russia. And that this is their, magnum opus of this investigation tells you how little they have about Russia and Russian collusion and Russian interference in the election of 2016.
Manafort's been in jail for a while. He had been allowed to have house arrest, but then that got taken away.
Yeah, well, apparently they claimed he was maybe trying to tamper with witnesses, I guess is the claim, and that's when he lost his liberty.
Yeah, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, that the tampering with potential witnesses was a communication he sent through a third party to some people in Ukraine who might be potential witnesses, suggesting or reminding them that when they were working for Yanukovych as lobbyists in Washington, and he obviously hadn't registered as a foreign agent, they were doing that as part of the effort to pull Ukraine into a Western orbit. In other words, that's an important thing. People in the media, people reading American media would think, Yanukovych, friend of Putin, friend of Russia, Manafort was his lobbyist. Ipso facto, Manafort is also working on behalf of the Russians. But what was happening actually is that the West and Russia were in a way competing for the allegiance of Ukraine's government under Yanukovych or any Ukraine government. And Yanukovych was sort of not with either or maybe with both. And Manafort's efforts perhaps were not viewed with extreme sympathy on the part of Russia if in fact this rich lobbyist, well connected to everybody in Washington, was pulling Yanukovych or trying to towards Europe and towards America.
Well, right. And again, I think people either they don't remember or they never knew because they were misled by the news that Yanukovych never did sign a deal with Russia, as a lot of people, I think, were misled to think. He was at the time he was overthrown, he was vacillating between the two trade deals, one with Europe or one with Russia. He had been offered a much better deal by Putin, and that would have helped his country out quite a bit, by the way. But he hadn't signed on yet. He was torn between the two, and that's when the coup happened. So to call him, to say he was in the tank of Russia or Putin is just totally untrue. And as you say, to the extent Manafort was trying to pull him towards the EU, that certainly would not make Manafort a tool of Russia either.
No. Here's another thing, John, that it seems obvious, but again, everything is so, I mean, everything in the U.S. media, like that Times article, Russia won't actually be mentioned. Like, wouldn't that be like a big news flash?
Right.
Wouldn't that be like sensational news that this first marquee, as you put a trial of the Mueller probe about Manafort, Trump's campaign chairman. And by the way, he was in that meeting, you know, that meeting with the Russian lawyer who was opposed to the Magnitsky Act, Natalia
right.
Veselitsnetskaya.
Right. Along with Jared Kushner and Donald
Trump
Jr.
So So Manafort, Kushner, and Trump were with her in that meeting at Trump Tower. And Trump Jr., I think, lied about the meeting or tried to present it as something else because he had been offered by Rob Goldstone, the promoter, that he said that the Russian lawyer had dirt on Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump Jr. and said, love it, let's meet. But then she showed up and she actually wanted to talk about the Magnitsky Act and about all of the issues associated with it. So the meeting was short-lived. Nonetheless, that is sort of a pivotal moment, Dan, in terms of the media, sort of indicting vis-a-vis the media, the Trump administration for collusion. Manafort was in that meeting with Kushner and Trump Jr. Why isn't that part of the trial if that's really collusion?
Well, again, because they obviously don't have the facts to back up a claim that it's collusion. And again, that should be the front page story. The front page story should be this is not about Russia, if the papers were honest about what's happening here. Instead, we get this barrage every day about Russian interference, alleged Russian interference, about how Russia is somehow a threat that justifies, you know, the continued propping up of NATO, when none of the above is true. And I'm just waiting for the day that maybe people will, you know, wake up to that fact.
Let's talk about what Manafort is exactly charged with. It's 18 violations of tax and banking laws. Prosecutors claim he hid millions of dollars in income from lobbying for Ukrainian politicians, including Yanukovych, all while failing to pay taxes and spending the money on U.S. real estate and personal luxury purchases. So what they're actually saying is Manafort got all this money from Ukrainians. He was lobbying because he's well-connected in Washington. By the way, he was also, I think, working with the Podesta Group, which is right. A Democratic outfit. And John Podesta is the brother of Tony Podesta, who's the leader of the Podesta Group. I think they, too, were doing lobbying in Ukraine, haven't been indicted yet. There were some rumors on right-wing media that Podesta had been offered immunity, in fact, to testify against Manafort. We don't know if that's true or not. That was a rumor. And again, mainly right-wing media sources. But what they're basically saying is he got all this money from Ukraine and he wanted to launder it so he didn't have to pay taxes on it. So he used the money to buy real estate in America, for instance, and then perhaps flip the real estate, sell it again, and thus the money would appear to be as a consequence of real estate sales rather than having come in an undeclared way from Ukrainian entities. Is that it, basically, Dan?
That sounds to be it. I mean, essentially, as you say, it's a form of money laundering. And of course, within that is probably a massive failure to pay taxes on those monies as well. That's really what we're talking about. By the way, if I could just add another fact, I mean, everyone was at this time was getting something out of Ukraine. People might recall that Vice President Joe Biden's son, after the coup against Yanukovych, was put on a board of the Ukrainian oil company there.
Yeah, that's true.
That's because he's an expert, right?
Right. I'm sure he knows all about the petrochemical industry.
Manafort is facing 305 years in prison. That's a lot of time. Three centuries.
It's a lot of time. Most of us won't live that long. Yes.
You know the old saying, too, especially in the Eastern District of Virginia, where this trial is taking place, that they would convict a bologna sandwich out there. The conventional wisdom is, well, if the cops charge you with a crime, you must have done it. And so nobody ever is found not guilty in the Eastern District of Virginia.
It might be satisfying for some people for Mueller to send Manafort to prison for 305 years. I guess he'll be about 370 then at the time his sentence ends. But on a serious note, what it seems to me is that Mueller is expecting or hoping that Manafort flips.
Yes.
Right? That's what this is about.
And until the jury comes in that room and says, Your Honor, we have a verdict, he can flip. Between now and the very, very end, he can still flip. And let me add one more thing, too. There's a federal regulation in the Justice Department that if you have more than 10 years on your sentence, you have to go at least to a medium security prison. A medium security prison is a real honest-to-God prison that you see on MSNBC in the middle of the night. So this would be a terrible, traumatic experience for somebody like Paul Manafort. Now, if he's facing hundreds of years in prison, this is going to be a situation like Rod Blagojevich, where he ended up with, I think it was 14 years or 14 and a half, and is sent to a real prison. I think that Manafort is softer than Rod Blagojevich even, and he's not going to want to be locked up in a steel cage until he's eligible to go to a minimum security camp.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yes, well, I totally agree with that. I guess, though, the $64,000 question is, does he have any relevant information to give? I mean, and that's really the question. And if he had, he might have given it by now. I mean, I think he's, you know, probably spending himself into bankruptcy on lawyers. And again, he is a pretty old guy, you know, and any time is going to be virtually a life sentence. My guess is if he had something to say, he might have flipped already, and which leads me to think he just doesn't have any information that's relevant to this Russia probe.
What about a pardon from Donald Trump?
That's the key right there.
Well, I think that's got to be a very real possibility. I mean, he seems to like to give pardons, as we've seen, and he likes to give pardons to celebrities when he can. I would think that that's a very real possibility if Manafort is convicted.
But if Manafort is facing other charges, which he is...
In a different district, by the way.
So Trump may have a limited capacity to pardon him completely. Thus, Manafort might really be in the vise. You would think that given the options, he would flip if he could flip. That's what I think. Anyway, who knows? We're just observers and have to be, like all Americans, fundamentally, existentially ignorant if we're getting our news from The New York Times and The Washington Post and CNN and Fox News. We're completely out of time. We've been joined from Pittsburgh by Dan Kovalik, a human rights and labor lawyer. He is the author of The Plot to Attack Iran, amongst many other books. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
President Donald Trump said yesterday that he would meet Iranian leaders without preconditions, quote, whenever they want, close quote. The comments marked an abrupt about-face in Trump's Iran policy, or it seems so. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo walked the comment back. The Iranian government has rejected the notion of such a meeting. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirande. He is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature, and he teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you. Of course, we had Trump speaking with the Italian prime minister saying, yeah, I'm ready to meet with the Iranian leadership, seemingly without conditions. Hours later, Mike Pompeo set numerous conditions. At the same time, the Iranian government said, not so interested in any kind of meeting under these circumstances. Go ahead.
Well, first of all, the very fact that Trump wrecked the nuclear deal is reason enough for Iran not to negotiate. If Trump is serious about resolving the problem between the two countries, he has to abide by agreements that the United States has signed up to. Otherwise, there's no reason why Iran should believe that after any future hypothetical negotiations, hypothetically speaking, that Trump will not back out of any potential agreement then. So as long as the United States under Trump does not return to the nuclear deal, there really is nothing to negotiate. We do not trust them. They've already been untrustworthy with regard to the nuclear deal. And the very fact that they're constantly threatening Iranians and imposing sanctions means that they're not serious in resolving the issue.
We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirande about Trump's offer to meet with the Iranian leadership without conditions. Mike Pompeo then setting conditions. Hours later, the Iranian government saying, what's the point, in essence? John, you know, Mohammed is right. I mean, what is there to talk about with the United States? I mean, this was a calculated, deliberate, premeditated effort by the Trump administration to destroy the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the Iran nuclear arms deal, that had, by all measures, the Iranian government had been living up to its obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's kind of a hubris here where the American media is like excitedly, maybe breathlessly talking about Trump has changed his position and offered to meet with Iran. What can we make of it?
Well, this is the danger of living in this echo chamber that we have here in Washington, where we keep repeating the party line so often that we lose sight of the bigger issue. First of all, you're absolutely right that the Iranians, by all accounts, were abiding by the terms of the JCPOA. Secondly, President Rouhani's statement yesterday rejecting this pseudo offer of talks was also correct in that the Iranians haven't changed their position on any of these issues. It's the Americans who have changed their position. And why would the Iranians enter into talks knowing that at some future date, whether it's 6 months from now or 6 years from now, the policy could change?
And I agree with you. And Mohammed, given all that, why do you think, if we can even tell, why did Donald Trump suggest that he was open to such a meeting with Iran under these conditions?
It's unclear, and that's another problem, because he is so unpredictable. It's very difficult to understand what's going on. And as you rightly pointed out, Pompeo himself, subsequent to the president's statement, put on his own conditions. So who's in charge? What's going on? No one knows. But the point is that Iran and the United States were already negotiating. The two sides were negotiating extensively. The foreign ministers had met each other regularly. Deputy foreign ministers were negotiating on a very regular basis. But it was Trump who brought all this to an end. And if he is upset about the nuclear deal, well, what many people in Iran are upset about the nuclear deal. Many people in Iran felt that the government gave too much. But once the country signed up to it, everyone agreed that Iran must abide by it. So how can Iran negotiate with Trump when he tears up agreements that the United States has signed up to, when he keeps shifting his position, when he is his statements are negated by his own Secretary of State? There really is no purpose in negotiating with the United States. And I think another problem is that Iranians are concerned that Trump may think that because of the sanctions and the pressure, Iranians are willing to give concessions. So any green light on behalf of Iran would be misinterpreted in Washington. Therefore, the Iranians are very adamant that we are willing to talk only after the United States has gone returns to the JCPOA, the nuclear deal, and abides by its commitments. Only then can we seriously consider negotiations.
I'm glad Mohammed has made that point, John, because, again, here in the United States, where the arrogance of power reigns supreme, people always think, well, will Trump meet with conditions or without conditions, as if the issue of what Iran thinks and feels and believes doesn't matter. But Iran has preconditions.
Sure,
and
it
the
does.
Precondition is, we're not going to talk to you unless you go back and abide by the agreement that you signed up for.
And a little bit more than that, President Rouhani said yesterday in his statement that as a precondition, the United States has to show respect for Iran. I mean, this is something that we always say, right? That we won't talk to the Iranians until they show respect for us, whatever that means. Well, the Iranians are now saying the same thing, that if President Trump wants to talk, that's fine, but we have to show appropriate respect for the Iranian government.
Yeah, and Mohammed, let's go over Mike Pompeo's ridiculously bizarre, imperialistic statements about, you know, how grateful the Iranians will be to negotiate with the U.S. But first, they must, quote, demonstrate a commitment to make fundamental changes in how they treat their own people, reduce their malign behavior, can agree that it's worthwhile to enter into a nuclear agreement that actually prevents proliferation. Then the president said he's prepared to sit down and have the conversation with them. I mean, dripping with arrogance, but you're in Iran. How would Iranians react to that? And specifically, how would they react to it?
I think the overwhelming majority simply will reject this. I mean, there are always going to be people who will say otherwise and let's give it a chance. But the overwhelming majority and the government itself, they know that this is useless. The very behavior and language of Pompeo shows that the United States is not someone under Pompeo or Trump, or this is not a government or a regime that is serious about negotiating. It shows no respect. The Iranians could say the same thing about Trump. They could say that we want to negotiate about the way you disrespect your own people, the way you disrespect minorities, the way you disrespect Latinos and African Americans and Muslims. So that has nothing to do with international relations. If Iran and the United States negotiated a deal, many in Iran were unhappy about it, but Iran signed up to it, Iran accepted it, and abided by it. The United States is, if it wants to continue talking with Iran, it has no option but to go back to the nuclear agreement.
Yeah, in June of this year, the U.S. State Department imposed new conditions on Iran beyond those of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. And again, you can't, is it organized hypocrisy? Or just, you know, because as you said, John Kiriakou said that America, the American media is simply an echo chamber, that they don't pick up on it. One of the demands is Iran must, quote, end its proliferation of ballistic missiles and halt further launching or development of nuclear capable missile systems. Now, we just saw the report. The U.S. is selling more weapons than any other country in the world.
By far.
It's modernizing its international continental ballistic missile system. It's doing new nuclear tests all the time and expanding and modernizing its own nuclear weapons program. It's the only country in the world that's ever used nuclear weapons. It's spent $8 trillion on nuclear weapons. I mean, when you look at that record of America, and then you have the State Department under the leadership of Mike Pompeo saying, oh, Iran must stop proliferating. It must stop building ballistic missiles. It must stop sending weapons abroad. I mean, what Iran does in any of those areas is like 0.01% of what America does.
Well, first of all, Iran's missile defense capability has nothing to do with nuclear weapons. In fact, Pompeo himself, when he was in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, when he wanted to become Secretary of State, he admitted that even before the nuclear deal, Iran wasn't pushing for a nuclear weapon. He said this basically because he wanted to say that when the United States pulls out of the nuclear agreement, don't worry, Iran's not going to go after a nuclear weapon because it wasn't doing so beforehand. So this demolishes the 10, 15 years of U.S. propaganda against Iran. But the reason why Iran has a missile defense capability is simply because the United States repeatedly threatens Iran with war. Under Obama, under Bush, under Clinton, and under Trump, the United States has repeatedly, U.S. presidents have repeatedly threatened Iran with war. All options are on the table. And in the case of Trump, his recent tweet is one of the most disgusting threats that a person can make against any other country. So it's obvious that Iran has no option but to have a missile defense system. And with regards to the region, it's Iran who feels that it should be making demands, because the United States helped, along with Saudi Arabia, helped create extremists with the help of Turkey as well and Qatar as well, unfortunately. They all helped create these extremist groups that have destroyed so much of Syria, Iraq, who are creating terrorist attacks even in Europe and the United States. These are the groups that the United States helped create, and it's a repetition of what we saw in Afghanistan in the 1980s, only much, much more dangerous and much more damaging. So if we want to talk about weapon systems or about the region or about treating one's own citizens, I think the Iranians can make the same statements about the United States. But the point is that if the United States is serious about talking with Iran, the only way forward is to show that they are trustworthy. If they want to show that they're trustworthy, then they have to go back and respect the commitments that they made beforehand, meaning the nuclear deal. Whether they like it or not, that is a commitment that the U.S. government made.
That's the voice of Mohammed Mirandi. Mohammed is an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature. He teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday, called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco again by Daniel Sankey. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. Daniel Sankey, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the new news that broke yesterday that the Trump administration is considering a unilateral tax cut for the rich. Now, a unilateral means without Congress being involved in the process. A unilateral effort on the part of the Trump administration to give tax breaks to rich people. Daniel, before we get into the specifics of what this means, Congress has two basic constitutional functions. One is to declare war. That's gone. The last time that happened was 1941. That's been a long time.
Long time.
So all these wars that have happened since have happened without a congressional declaration of war. Okay, so that's gone. And the second power it has is the power of the purse. Only the Congress can approve the budget and ultimately must approve all of the instruments by which the budget achieves buoyancy, meaning the instruments to raise funds, like taxes. How does the Trump administration do a unilateral tax cut for the rich, and why?
Yeah, I think this is really the most important part of the story. We'll discuss the details, but this part really matters. So what the Trump administration is proposing is that the Treasury Department has the authority to unilaterally change how they tax capital gains and wouldn't be able to do that without input from Congress and without approval from Congress. It's not clear if that's going to be possible. If he was actually to attempt to do this and the Treasury Department was to go along with it, there would almost certainly be a whole host of lawsuits trying to prevent it from happening. That being said, that doesn't mean it wouldn't happen. So what they're alleging is that the Treasury Department has the right to adjust these taxes, because what they're doing is not so much changing the tax rates, but they're allowing inflation to be part of the calculation of these taxes. So what they're saying is right now there's these things called capital gains taxes. And what those taxes are taxes on profits made through an investment. And that investment could be in a stock or it could be in a home. And it could be in a lot of other things that are defined as assets. Now, most working people don't ever get taxed on capital gains. They have to spend their money to survive. They don't have the opportunity to speculate on the stock market. They can't risk losing their money. Some working people do get capital gains taxes in the forms of selling their homes when perhaps they're downsizing or they're retired or they're moving on and they were able to acquire a home. And what it does is it taxes the profit that you made on that home. So if you bought a home for $100,000 and then you sold it for $500,000, that difference of $400,000 would be taxed. It'd be taxed as capital gains. What the Treasury Department is saying is what they want to do is they're not changing that rule. You'll still get taxed on capital gains. But they're allowing inflation to be calculated in. So there's going to be a time frame between when that house is worth $100,000 and when the house is worth $500,000. And naturally, there's going to be a certain inflation rate during that time period. And what they're saying is we'll allow that inflation rate to be calculated in to your capital gains tax. So what that will do is it will dramatically reduce the profit that you gained on that home as far as the tax bracket's concerned and allow people to pay a lot less taxes. Now, the vast majority of people that pay capital gains are the very, very wealthy, for whom the vast majority of their money is in assets. They're not using it to survive. They're using it to invest. So it will allow them to basically camouflage or subterfuge how much money they've made through the veil of inflation and pay a lot less on taxes on all these. It would be a huge tax break to the tune of roughly $100 billion. And they're saying that the Treasury Department can do this because they're not changing the tax code. They're just changing how we define price, and they're allowing inflation to be calculated in, which is really extremely deceptive.
The tax rate on long-term gains was reduced in 1997 via the Taxpayer Relief Act of that year, of 1997. It was reduced from 28% to 20%. And that was, again, during the Clinton administration. We've seen, Daniel, when you look back to the past 70 years, post-World War II, during the boom period for the United States, as a country, the tax rates for corporations, the tax rates for rich people have gone down and down and down, so that even though the rich, the very rich, were taxed at a high rate and still continued to live a pretty good life, that's all been undercut. And it seems to me And we've talked about this with others. You know, we had a discussion last week about modern monetary theory, that the function of taxes is in some ways, or at least a progressive tax, in some ways is to reduce inequality, to make the country more equal. So if the rich are paying, say, 90% of their wealth to taxes, they don't have that much of an incentive to keep getting more and more and more and more, right? I mean, they still have an incentive. But you see all these CEO payouts and all of this other sort of accumulation of fabulous wealth at one pole in society. It's because this money isn't taxed. And as a consequence, the rich have this sort of constant incentive to do more, more, more. Anyway, talk about the impact of this on inequality in America.
Yeah, there's a lot that can be said. I mean, first of all, when, you know, we kind of, and the Trump administration does this too, talks about the good old days, you know, in the 50s and 60s when America was super prosperous. The tax rates for the very wealthy, for corporations, were, you know, 70% and over. It was extremely high, and yet that was considered the boom times, and everybody was doing well. And you can also point out that even though the tax rates were very high, it certainly did not stop investment, and it didn't stop millionaires from getting richer. They certainly didn't go home and say, oh, the tax rate's too high, I'm just going to, you know, sweep the street, I'm not going to, you know, start a corporation. They were very happy to make their millions, even at that high tax rate, and it didn't hurt society at all. We had a very robust economy. You're right about taxes reducing income inequality when they're progressive. That's very important to say, because if the ultra-rich are being taxed at a higher rate than the working-class people, then yes, it helps reduce income inequality. But the reverse is also true, which is the current situation we're living under now, where the very rich are taxed at a much lower rate than working-class people. This aggravates income inequality. It's bad enough already when they have, you know, outsized influence and wealth in the world. But when these taxes favor them and allow them to pay yet even less while requiring people like you and I to pay even more, it simply makes the income inequality worse and worse and worse. And that's the direction we're headed in. There's this idea that somehow, you know, if we didn't tax them so much, we'd have this huge, robust economy. And yet that's just patently false. The times when we had the most robust economy, we had extremely progressive tax rates where the very wealthy paid a larger share than the not so wealthy. And it worked. And it created a more equitable world, certainly, than we're living in right now.
You know, I wanted to ask too, Daniel, this the whole notion of further cuts in the capital gains tax, this has long been red button issue for the Republicans, going back to the Reagan administration. Realistically, can capital gains be cut anymore? Isn't it true that if you have held an investment for longer than 18 months, that 20% is actually cut again to 15%?
Yes, absolutely. So the longer you hang on to an asset, stay invested in it, if you sell it and make a profit, you get an even lower tax rate. That was brought on by President Reagan. Capital gains in the long term were then even further reduced, as Brian mentioned, by Clinton in 96. And really, the tax rates are extremely low. Now, we as income taxpayers pay 30-35% on average,
right,
versus long term capital gains is 15%. So less than half, right? They pay less than half taxes. And we also have to understand these are investments. This isn't, you know, money to survive. Our income, we need to survive. If we stop getting our income, we quickly become homeless, we quickly become destitute. If they lose money gambling on the stock market, not only do their lives continue unabated, they actually have tax benefits and breaks where if you lose money on investments, you can use that as a tax write-off. So you can actually subsidize the losses you have on certain assets at the taxpayer's expense. So really, the system is very much rigged for speculation and for people to make money off of assets versus people making money off of working hard. We have this myth in America, you know, you work real hard and then you get ahead and you get successful and you get wealthy because you're such a hard worker. That's simply not true. Nowadays, you make money by having money already, by inheriting it or some other means, and by then investing it and turning it into even more. Working hard has nothing to do with it. There's many working people who work two, three, sometimes four jobs to make ends meet, and they're not, you know, getting wildly ahead. They're you know, in a poverty level. So, and that in part, this has to do with the tax code and how it favors the ultra rich.
And let's just remember about the way this system, because we talk about this is the system of corporate capitalism, modern day capitalism. I mean, when you had Facebook shares dropped precipitously in the last week. John, what was the number you had it memorized? How much it lost overnight?
Oh, yeah, it was something like 30-something billion dollars.
Yeah, I thought it was even more.
I'll look for it.
Yeah, but Mark Zuckerberg lost $16 billion. That's 1,600 millions. $16 billion overnight. That's the kind of obscene wealth. If you can lose $16 billion overnight, I mean, he could have slept. He could have been playing handball.
It's $120 billion.
Yeah. Okay. Facebook lost $120 billion overnight. Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO, lost $16 billion. When you think about it that way, it's all ill-gotten wealth because nobody's actually earning or losing because of their own efforts. Those kind of monies. That's a consequence of a system where vis-a-vis ownership over a platform that the public uses, 2.5 billion people use Facebook. And yet it's for the personal benefit of Mark Zuckerberg because he has the title. He's the landlord. He's the lord of the land when it comes to Facebook land. And as a consequence of that system of ownership, you have this kind of gargantuan inequality and disparities in wealth. And of course, no human being actually needs $16 billion or $160 billion or any of these substantial numbers that the billionaires have. And the billionaires now have, like, in aggregate, the same amount of wealth as the lowest 60% of the people of the planet. I'm talking about 500 or 1,000 individuals.
Yep.
I mean, it's so gross and obscene, but that's modern-day corporate capitalism. That's where we are. And then the argument, Daniel, is that if we give them more money, if we give the rich even more money, if we make sure that they can have an even lower capital gains tax, then not only because they don't need the money, it must be for some socially beneficial purpose, that money will be used by them to create jobs, to invest, to help the rest of us. It will, in fact, trickle down. Does it trickle down?
It does not trickle down. what we've seen right now is the explosion of financialization in our economy, which basically means that people make money off of financial speculation and not the creation of jobs, the opening of factories, the producing of some kind of good or service that people want. People make it by speculating on foreign interest exchange rates or speculating on markets in other countries or just, you know, simply speculating on complex derivatives. They don't actually go and then make money. And I think make jobs. They make tremendous money, but they don't produce jobs and they don't produce opportunities for working people. I think when we talk about the Facebook example, I mean, we have to ask ourselves, you know, where did all this money come from? And where it came from was the identities and personal information of the users on their platform, which they took many times without the user's knowledge or permission, as a lot of court documents are now finding out, which they then sold and profited off of. So they stole information from people, lied to them about it, sold it, made a lot of money, and we're supposed to somehow hail them as job creators and brilliant, you know, people and innovators. There's nothing innovative about this. This is information that is sold to make money off of, and they're taking it from people and giving them nothing in return. Our identities, our interactions are where they get their money from, and they're the source of their income, which is why when they announced recently that they were losing users, their stock price collapsed, right? Because the users are the whole reason they're making money. And if there's less users, then they're going to be making less money. So we really need to stop this romantic notion that these, you know, very wealthy billionaires are going to somehow voluntarily benefit society and give us all these jobs if we just gave them a little more money. They have tremendous wealth. There's no reason why they would not that would hold back from creating jobs, unless, of course, creating jobs isn't as profitable as investing it in all these speculative investments, which it is. So the more money we give them, the more they'll speculate with it, the more they'll gamble with it, and they certainly won't be using it to create more jobs for us. And it's time we started recognizing that as a people, as a society.
And people don't know because Facebook seems benign and friendly and we have friends. We are the commodity.
Yeah.
We are the commodity. And we've voluntarily become the commodity, even though we don't think of ourselves as the commodity, because we want to have access to that social media, because, of course, that's a step forward for humanity to be able to create these kind of communities. It has so many benefits. And yet, under corporate capitalism, it's we the people, because we want to enjoy the fruits of this technology, which, by the way, Mark Zuckerberg did not create. because we want to enjoy the fruits of the technology, we become the commodity. We're joined every Tuesday by Daniel Sankey in this segment of Loud and Clear called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism. Let's go into another story talking about how we're being bought and sold as the commodities. There's another story you submitted, Daniel, about what's happening to high school students. Go ahead.
Yeah, so this was published in the New York Times, where high school kids who are, you know, entering kind of the realm of college applications and are taking things like the SATs and other sort of preparatory exams are also given the opportunity in those exams to fill out some additional surveys and forms talking about their background and their interests. And they're told that by filling out these forms, it'll help us identify good colleges for you, and it'll help us find a good fit for colleges. So a lot of, you know, it just seems like this benign survey, and all these kids are in the middle of trying to figure out where they want to go and what they want to do. And so, sure, why not get some more information? And what they're finding is that these different companies that host these surveys are then in turn selling the students' data to other corporations that are using them to market to the students and to get them to hooked into different kind of honor programs and different academies, which cost money to join, and selling those academies to their parents and to the kids, trying to get them to, you know, pay for, you know, the honor of going to some sort of, you know, boot camp or whatever. Now, regardless of the, you know, advantage of those things, the point is that they're harvesting data from underage people many times, and then they're selling it, which is potentially very illegal. However, the regulatory environment is such that it's not very clear exactly what's legal and what's illegal. And in general, it doesn't seem like a lot of it's illegal. So what's happening is, you know, this is kind of sort of like the Facebook effect, where they're claiming to give you these recommendations for these colleges for free, just out of the goodness of their own heart. But what they're doing is they're harvesting data from these students who are unwittingly providing it without disclosures, without consent and involvement of their parents. And it's simply being sold to other corporations so they can market to them and their parents.
You know, we're seeing this more and more, too. A lot of Americans have had their DNA tested through companies like 23andMe or genealogy.com. There are a whole bunch of them. And these companies also sell your data to Big Pharma to help them develop drugs. Now, in the end, that may be a great thing. Maybe you, in a direct way, can help to cure Parkinson's disease or cancer, whatever. But you have to opt out. You have to physically opt out. Otherwise, your data is automatically sold. So it's not just what we saw in the New York Times. It's all over the place. It's not just Facebook. It's everybody. Everybody's selling our
data. And again, just think about, people want to know about their roots, right? That's
right.
What it's about.
Sure.
This whole genealogy thing. And then, as you said, maybe selling the data to some entity might come out with something good, because for, you know, the modern genome project or pharmaceutical-based things. But that's not the point of the selling. The point of the selling is to make money. If something good comes from it, that's sort of a side effect.
Right.
But it's not the main motivation.
No, it's profit-driven.
And we don't know. Those people who want to find out about their roots, they don't know that what they're actually doing is becoming a commodity so that somebody else can sell your private information.
That's right.
They don't know.
That's exactly right. And I think the 23andMe is a great example, because frankly, that model really frightens me, because they've collected all this data. They're selling it to Big Pharma. You have to opt out of it. There's so many things to consider. One is the security of the data. Hacks are very popular in this day and age, and they happen to some, even the most sophisticated companies. Your data could be hacked. It could be stolen. But even aside from that, even if 23andMe is totally benign and they're just simply making money and selling it according to all the very, you know, strict laws and regulations, what happens if there's an administration or some sort of state where they want access to where all the Latinos live? Hey, we want to see where, you know, in our database, certain ethnic groups live and certain ethnicities are. We want to see the demographics of society for reasons that are far less, you know, that are less than savory. You know, we think of our current administration and the sympathies towards white supremacy, and that sort of stuff really frightens me, because just because 23andMe is collecting the data and maybe they're being really ethical, let's give them the benefit of the doubt, it doesn't mean other actors who can have power over them are going to behave ethically. And so when we look at all this data, you know, that Facebook tracks and collects, who you are, who you know, what you're interested in, where you are, even if Facebook and things like that are extremely honest and ethical, it doesn't mean that other entities won't be. As we've seen, the NSA will happily take that information by force, by one way or another, from them and use it to, you know, exploit people and to surveil people. What we're seeing in our age now is this tremendous shift. You know, capital used to be about commodities. Then it became about financial instruments. And now it's about information. Information is the new commodity. It's our identities are bought and sold, and it's a way of speculating and making money and engaging in social control. And it's a really serious development in our society that we need to, you know, really think about and engage with how these companies are using our data, because right now they're really taking advantage of us.
You know, Christopher Wray just made the announcement. We talked about this last week, John, that the FBI has active investigations about Chinese espionage.
Right.
In all 50 states.
Yes.
And Christopher Wray made it very clear that the FBI is targeting Chinese people because they're considered suspect.
Just because they're Chinese.
Just because they're Chinese. So Daniel's raising a really important point about the genealogy outfits, which are also working with law enforcement. Again, people want to know their roots. You find out, is part of my heritage from this place or that place? The law enforcement is using that to solve unsolved crimes. But also, if you have law enforcement targeting whole peoples, as Christopher Wray made it clear, the U.S. intelligence is targeting people of Chinese ethnicity. And of course, we all know that the American government targeted people of Japanese ethnicity when the United States identified Japan as the threat because of at the beginning of World War II, Japanese people were rounded up and sent to internment camps. This is not speculation about some sort of terrible future, sort of sci-fi. This is what actually has happened in America. Daniel, go ahead.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think of the whole Russiagate, you know, hysteria right now. When do they start targeting Russian people just for being Russian and that they're spies and seditionists? Same thing with Chinese folks. You know, there's this hysteria in the intelligence community that the Chinese are hacking and stealing our information. And while certainly there's corporate espionage on both sides, it's really taken to an extreme where average everyday people who happen to be of Chinese ancestry, maybe have family in China that they're still connected with, of course, become targets, you know, for the surveillance state. 23andMe would make it real easy to find people of Russian descent, people of Chinese descent. You're turning over what? Your name, your address to them because they have to mail you the results, probably your email, maybe your phone number. They have all this information now and they can tie you to a genetic profile so they know exactly your ethnic background, which is probably something that is a little harder for Facebook to curate, although I imagine they can still make some pretty educated guesses. It's not dystopian. We rounded up Japanese people and put them in internment camps during World War II for no other reason than they were Japanese and we happened to be at war with their country of origin. We're rounding up Latinos right now and immigrants from South America and separating them from their kids in a form of child abuse and torture as a way of terrifying them and terrorizing them. There's no reason to think that this administration or ones in the future won't take advantage of that information. If they come with a subpoena or some kind of national security letter to Facebook or to 23andMe, there's very little those companies can do to resist it. They'll quickly be seized and thrown in jail if they choose not to surrender that data, and they most certainly will. So if we're out there and we're using all these supposedly free services that don't cost anything and they're just so much fun, why would they make it for free? Why, out of the goodness of their own hearts? No, we're the commodity. We're the product. We're paying for it with our identities, and we're paying for it with our privacy, with our, you know, ability to be kind of, you know, independent individuals on our own. And this is something we really need to consider because it goes beyond just the economic into the heart of social control, how we develop a society, and the ability for the state to exert coercive power over its citizens as a way of exerting control.
Those are excellent points. And we know after 9/11, South Asians, Arabs, people of Iranian descent, thousands were
Sikhs.
Thousands of people were rounded up, again, not because of what they did, but because of who they were. Daniel, we have about 4 minutes left. Next headline that you submitted, and this is really an important one, again, flying under the radar, tariffs finally hit home in the pocketbook of workers. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal where they're talking about how the tariff prices are finally impacting consumers, because they are impacting things like aluminum, steel and a lot of other imported components, which consumers use quite a bit. So, for example, buying sodas or buying drinks. And it's causing the prices of these things to hop up even further. It's a lot of day-to-day things that people use in their day-to-day lives, agricultural products, products that are related to aluminum, things like that. And it's causing the consumer, working people, to have to pay more. And the reason why is, you know, if you impose tariffs on the EU or on China, they're going to retaliate. They're going to engage in retaliatory tariffs, and they're going to punish the U.S. back as a way of trying to exert control and balance it. Well, these tariffs then are in turn hurting, you know, these working people as these countries try to find some kind of defense against the onslaught of the U.S.'s current, you know, tariff administration.
And Daniel, there's one other element to it as well. And we talked about this in the past. When the price of foreign steel goes up because tariffs are 25%, that means it costs 25% more for an American consumer, a company, to buy steel. That's allowed the U.S. Steel companies like U.S. Steel to raise their prices up to 25%. They're not selling them at 25% below market price. They just raised those prices up. So now car makers, for instance, are saying they can't buy steel at the rate they were buying it a year ago, even from American steel producers, and thus American car purchasers, those of us who are buying cars in retail, we're going to pay more for those cars.
Yeah. And it shows the ignorance of this administration, their inability to understand these economic movements, because this is all very predictable. If your competition has to raise their prices 25%, you can raise your price 20%, make a profit, and still beat your competition. Why wouldn't you raise your prices 20% and make more money? Which is exactly what's happening. And so all these U.S. companies are doing that, and the consumers are the ones that are getting hit, because at some point you need those, you know, materials. You need things to drink, things to eat, agricultural products to survive. So, of course, you're going to pay extra, and you're going to find, you know, some way to trim your budget back in another area so you can do these things. And that's exactly what's happening. So it's not even just the retaliatory tariffs. It's the fact of this constant drive for profit that these other corporations are engaging in by artificially inflating their prices because they can get away with it. And the Trump administration should know better. It's very obvious this is going to happen. This always happens when there's trade wars. It's very predictable. And they're very dishonest and disingenuous when they try to pretend like somehow these tariffs are going to benefit working people, because they most certainly are not.
Sadly, people are the victims not only of deception, but self-deception, and the two are interconnected. So we're reading lots of stories of people, even in Midwestern states, people who are losing their jobs because the price of steel has gone up. And some of them are saying, well, it's terrible, but, you know, Trump is standing up for the Americans. It's kind of this version of identity politics on a grand scale, Americanism. We must be Americans. We are Americans. Trump is an American. He's doing things for America. Of course, he's hurting so-called American workers, but it's part of the grand scheme to make America great again.
Yeah, we'll see how long that lasts. I want to point one last thing out before we leave, and that is that, you know, take a look at tractors, just as one example. A lot of John Deere tractors are mostly made, a majority of the parts are made in Asia. But if you look at a Komatsu tractor, most of the Komatsu tractor is made in the United States. So you have a lot of people running out there and shouting, buy American, and they're running to the John Deere dealership and buying a John Deere tractor. In fact, it's a Chinese tractor.
Yeah, people don't know. 20 seconds, Daniel.
I think it's really important that we have segments like this so people can educate themselves and understand the sorts of things that John's talking about and that we're talking about, so that we can really have a proper understanding and analysis of what's happening with the Trump administration, and not just blindly follow CNN, CBS, Fox News, and believe in their particular propaganda. We need to educate ourselves and arm ourselves with information.
And that is the value of this segment. That's why we're so, so happy that we're able to do it every week on Tuesday at Loud and Clear. This is called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.